Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us for our continued podcast series, The Drive to Level 5, the podcast series devoted to autonomous vehicles, which is what the Drive World Conference and Expo event is about in Santa Clara, California, on August 27th to 29th. This is the only Drive World Conference devoted to hey, Tim, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm going to start again. I tripped over some of my own tongue there. Give me a second. I can edit this.
All good.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us today for the continuing podcast series, The Drive to Level 5, Level 5 being our goal for autonomous self-driving vehicles. And we have been, as many of you have commented, having a speaker every week between now and the Drive World Conference and Expo taking place August 27th to 29th in Santa Clara, California. Today, our guest is Tim Wong, Technical Marketing at NVIDIA, who's one of the exhibitors at the Santa Clara Drive World Conference. Tim will be doing a panel discussion on the timeline to getting to Level 5 autonomy, as well as doing his own presentation, Realizing Autonomy Through Sensors, Simulation, and Safety. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, our pleasure. Tim, I thought maybe a good place to start before we get into the conference and your discussions and all that, is tell us a little bit about NVIDIA and your role there. I noticed on your homepage it says Get Superpowers, which is a well-timed topic because this past weekend my wife, son, and I saw the last Avengers movie. So superpowers are a hot topic around here. So tell us about the superpowers at NVIDIA, if you can take a minute for that.
Absolutely. As you know, we make something called the GPU, Graphical Processing Unit. But what a GPU really does is it enables you to have superpowers, enables you to do things that you normally can't do. And the way we do that is that a CPU, and just kind of taking a step back, as you know, has 2,
yep,
4, 8, 12 cores, right? You have it in your phone, you have it in your PC, and it's got a bunch of cores. Well, a GPU has thousands of cores. And for example, our Pegasus drive computer has 11,000 cores. So if you want to do complex tasks, if you want to do AI, if you want to do parallel processing, you're going to do this on a GPU. And that's why, you know, we call it superpowers, because we're enabling things you couldn't do before. And you know, at a speed, and it's just taking the world by storm. And so we love enabling people, and that's what we're,
mm-hmm,
about. So if you want superpowers and you want to be able to do superhuman things, that's us.
That's NVIDIA. Okay. So let's tie that into I did a little reading on your on the company there. You're certainly not a new company. Late 80s or early 90s was your founding? Is that correct?
Mid-90s, yeah.
Mid-90s, excuse me. So the superpowers that you're enabling now, how is that tying into the autonomous vehicle and to the Drive World Conference?
So very perfectly, because driving, autonomously driving, let me be clear, is probably one of the most complex problems the human race has had to solve. And, you know, yes, a 16-year-old human can drive. You know, that's what we can do when we get our driver's license. But they grew up for 16 years being human. So they understand when I only see the nose peeking out from the side of a car, there's probably a human that's about to step out in front of me, and they understand these things. But trying to get a car to understand not only the world around it, but the real tough part is I need to predict where everyone's about to be in the next few seconds so I can figure out my safest path forward. That ends,
right,
up being a pretty complex problem, as well as predicting all the bad human drivers out there. You know, you have all these crazy human drivers doing ridiculous things, and you sadly have to deal with it. So having all of that, it becomes an AI problem, a complex problem, a parallel processing problem, where I'm going to do a lot of different things. I need to figure out where the lane is. I need to figure out where all the objects are, where those objects are going, whether they're coming toward me, going away from me. You know, are they a threat? A box falls off a truck, if I see it blowing around, you and I know there's nothing in the box because it's blowing around. But if it falls off the truck and goes thud, I'm going to steer around it, right, because there's probably something heavy inside. So we know all these things, being human and understanding context, and this is why we, have to get the cars to be, as smart or hopefully smarter than we are. The good news is that we have two eyes that we drive with, and we have mirrors and things to help us, but essentially our attention is wherever we happen to be looking, whereas an autonomous car does look around in all directions all the time. And so there is no concept of blind spots for an autonomous car. So, that's the hope, is that we get to a point where there's no more fatalities and no more accidents. I can see in, you want to talk 30, 40 years out where cars no longer have to be, as robust as they are today. The steel frame and the doors and the airbags and all those things are because we crash into each other.
Right.
When we get to the point where it's all autonomous cars, you're not going to have things crashing into each other, so you can make the cars lighter, thinner, much more maneuverable. It'll be a very different world.
So you said a couple things there that I'm very curious about. So before we get to level five and that whole debate, you used a terrific phrase there about, I forget exactly how you put it, but solving like a complex problem. So I'd like to describe to you a situation I personally was in close to a year and a half ago, where I could proactively see a problem developing. The problem did develop, but I avoided the accident because I could see what was coming. And the situation was this. I was going down a highway in Maryland on a bad, rainy, chilly day when the temperature was just hovering around freezing. So there was a lot of sleet on the road. The visibility was bad. And everybody was doing it's like a 65, normally a 65-mile-an-hour turnpike. Everybody's doing 40, 45, which is the most you should be doing. There were bad conditions. And I was the appropriate number of car lengths behind a car in front of me. I think I was like four. I'll say I was about four car lengths in front of me. On my left, I was in the center lane. In the left lane, a small car going way too fast comes flying up on the left-hand side, and I said, that guy's going too fast. Now, I drove a very heavy car at the time, so I wasn't concerned for me, but I saw him pulling up next to the car in front of me that was several lengths. I thought, this car could start hydroplaning. It's very light. It's a bad condition. He's going too fast. The air currents under the two vehicles side by side could start to cause hydroplaning. I immediately started to slow down, and sure enough, within a few seconds, both those cars started to spin toward each other and went 90 degrees, and they were nose to nose going sideways down the turnpike.
and slowing down 100 feet
in front of me.
Yep.
Now, your system, I have no doubt, would react proactively once those cars start to spin. My question is, is it possible to build a system that would have been thinking as proactively as I was, saying this car is going too fast, it's small, it's light, it's going to start to hydroplane, or at least it could, and I was slowing down before the accident even happened, and I was able to move over and avoid it. Is that kind of proactive processing going to be possible, or is there always going to have to be some level of driver oversight?
And the short answer is yes. The more complex answer is your scenario, believe it or not, is actually an easy scenario, and I'll explain
really
why. That, we're monitoring all the objects around the car, and we're predicting where they're going to be in the next few seconds based on their current trajectory, speed, and distance from us. And basically, we're picking, what we do with our actuators and our best path forward to get to where we want to go, and we're doing this 30 times a second. So if you think about this, you have some reaction time. You notice something, you think about it, I guess I should take my foot off the accelerator, there's a delay there. So the car is actually, reacting to things 30 times a second. The other thing that's kind of interesting, especially for wet conditions like that, is that you have three controls at your disposal: steering, brake, and throttle. There is no reason why an autonomous car couldn't independently control each for the four wheels. And can you imagine that to get traction back, maybe you pulse the corner wheels and then you alternate corners. You do a bunch of weird things with steering into the thing, but you steer the four wheels differently, right? It can manage all those four wheels totally independently of each other, which is something beyond what you could do. And so the car hopefully is more maneuverable because I can do those things. Imagine you need to stop because those cars, as they went 90 degrees facing each other, started to slow down very fast. And you, because you don't want to start hydroplaning, are not going to hit the brakes too fast. So there are car companies that are experimenting with doing a hockey stop where I move the front wheels out, kind of at an angle to each other, like a hockey stop, and then I angle them into the road, so then as the hood dips, I'm still hitting the road, with the maximum surface area. So the cars, the controls of the cars, and the way the cars can handle themselves is very different. The fact that the car computer is looking at what's going on 30 times a second in all directions, so it's tracking this car as it's coming up really fast, it understands that there's water on the road, it understands what that speed of that car is, and it actually understands the size of that car. So it's taking all these things into account and, can behave or react similarly to how you react, but without any kind of delay in should I do this or should I do that? I mean, because, for better or worse, humans are indecisive sometimes. And,
yes,
you said that was an easy case. I'll give you the tougher case. I had this with my daughter. She's 16 years old. She's now 18. But when she was 16, we were driving and going down a two-way street, and someone is in a driveway about to turn left in front of us, but they're looking the other way. Well, what do you think is going to happen? I told my daughter, be ready to stop because that person may just jet out in front of us without looking. And that's exactly what happened. And she panic braked. We came inches from hitting this car. I actually thought we were going to hit. But again, to an autonomous car today, there's no threat because they haven't entered the roadway, right? As soon as it starts moving, the autonomous car knows. But understanding bad intent, understanding that that driver has not looked at you yet, so they don't know you're there, which means that they just may pull out in cross traffic when they're not clear. That's where you have to now get the understanding of intent into these computers, and that's a tougher problem. The other one that's mundane for us but harder for a computer is, say you have a line of parked cars on the right side, and someone just parked because you saw that up ahead, and the passengers have gotten out. Well, that driver door hasn't opened yet, so you're going to either slow down or go wide because you understand a car has a driver and the driver hasn't gotten out yet. To an autonomous car, there's no threat. There's parked cars, and, but you need to get that now time, temporal component of, the car being parked, recently parked, and the driver door hasn't opened yet as a threat. So these are the problems that are hard to deal with. The perception side of understanding what, is all going on in the world, the physics of it, what could potentially happen, that's actually fairly controlled. It's the unpredictable human side and the context of what cars are and they have people inside, or, a ball rolls out of a car, well, a kid may run after it, right? Understanding those kinds of things, that's the hard part of autonomous driving.
That's the more challenging part. So, first off, I wanted to say thank you for that insight about each tire being controlled independently. I hadn't thought of that, and I'll bet a lot of people hadn't. And those are great examples of what the things that are harder to program an autonomous vehicle to do. So let's go right to it. Your panel discussion is the timeline to getting to level 5 autonomy. Is it realistic? So before we get to that question, for everyone's benefit, would you please define level 5 autonomy just so everyone's working from the same page?
Absolutely. So level 5 is an autonomous vehicle that is autonomous all the time, in all conditions, in all places. So essentially it is the ultimate goal for autonomous vehicles, that a car can be autonomous no matter whether it's on urban streets, no matter whether it's in a crowded city, no matter whether it's, in a rural, dirt roads, in any condition, whether it's raining, when it's foggy, in any condition, any time of day, no matter how much water is on the road. Of course, if it's floating, probably it's not autonomous. But, essentially, any reasonable amount of obstacles, it can drive safely, autonomously. That is level 5.
Okay. So where are we? Well, where are we with to level 5, and if that's the goal, and what level would you say we're at today? 2, 3? I wouldn't think we're at 4, but you tell us.
Well, here's the good news. The things you need for level 5, the building blocks, are the same mm-hmm. building blocks you use for 2 and 4. And I'm going to leave 3 out because 3 is conditional autonomy or restricted autonomy, and basically you have 2, what I call 2 plus, which is basically smart cruise control, right? That, it'll steer in the lane, it'll, keep me in my lane, it'll follow the car in front, but, it does it through a lot of different conditions. Level 4 is, where I can certainly drive autonomously, but I can also hand control back to the driver, so it can do either one. What we see is a focus on both, that for passenger cars, there's a focus on level 2 plus, that basically taking the cruise control and smart drive systems that we have today, Tesla started it with autopilot, GM has Super Cruise. There's a lot of different names for these things, but it's basically very smart cruise control. But because it's cruise control, you may remember when you started driving, cruise control used to be just hold the speed, right? And if you traffic stops right next to you and you're not paying attention, it'll crash you right into traffic at the speed you set. So it's supposed to be supervised. So these systems today, I sadly see videos of people on the Autobahn doing, getting in the back seat when it's just cruise control, which would scare me, since it's supervised, which means that you have to be paying attention. You have to, essentially, it's a workload reliever. Tesla calls it autopilot, and, which does make sense because, I used to be a student pilot for airplanes, and, an autopilot in an airplane holds altitude and holds heading, but, that's all it does. So if you, put it at 10,000 feet and you're heading toward a 12,000-foot mountain, you're going to crash on the side of a mountain. It's not smart enough to take you around the obstacle. That's
right.
Not what autopilot is
right.
for. It's just supposed to, so you don't have to keep managing your altitude and managing your heading. So in the same way, holding the lane and keeping your speed at a targeted speed is essentially what these level 2 plus systems do. And you're going to see where, we announced with Volvo that we're going to help them get their cars to level 2 plus. But already you have Tesla's autopilot and GM Super Cruise that do a pretty good job of holding the lane and following the car in front in a lot of different conditions. Level 4, you're seeing companies like Google's Waymo, Uber, a lot of people testing these things. There's a company, Nutonomy, that started in Singapore. Now they're testing in Boston. Navya is doing a shuttle in Las Vegas. They're all testing essentially level 4 autonomy and, in a very specific geofenced area. And so I think you're going to see, level 4 and level 5 being tested now. I guess you can't really call it level 5 yet because it's not in all conditions. So in very specific conditions for level 4 in a very specific locale, they are testing these things, with safety drivers, ready to take over, but essentially they're testing the full autonomy aspect of it. So you're seeing that today. In very small locales, and I think as time goes forward, you're going to see these locales get bigger and bigger. Of course, doing it on a highway is a lot easier than doing it in an urban environment. So
yes.
I also think you're going to see a lot more deployments of autonomy on highways than you will in the city, because in the city you've got jaywalkers, you've got the person who wants to catch your eye before they run in front of you, right? There's all sorts of craziness that happens in the city that you don't have to really worry about on a major highway, right? In a major highway, it's unidirectional. The cars are relatively going the same speed or much closer to each other. You don't have cross traffic as much. There's not, the person who wants to turn left in the right lane and cause all sorts of havoc. I think you're going to continue to see that progression.
Now, thank you for that summary. That, I think, brings people up to a good, state of the art today. So that last three words there in the panel discussion title, is it realistic, level five. You have a great deal of enthusiasm in your voice. You've got a great deal of conviction. It sounds like passion for the technology. I'm going to take a guess, and you tell me if my guess is wrong. You think it is possible, but maybe the question mark is the timeline. Would that be accurate?
So I absolutely think it's possible, and I have a 50-mile commute in heavy traffic, so I'm the first person to sign up and use one of these things. Because, you know, I jokingly tell people, you know, I can teach my 10-year-old daughter how to drive to work, because it's basically for 48 miles of the 50 miles, it is stay in your lane, follow the car in front. You know, I also add don't let anyone in, but, you know, for her, I can, and it's basically, and she's basically holding the brake and letting off the brake almost 90% of the time, because it's really heavy traffic, so I'm going, you know, under 10 miles an hour most of the time. That's not hard to teach a car, right? But I would love to be able to sit back and actually work or read or, you know, do something other than sitting in traffic for 2 to 3 hours each way. So, you know, that is why I'm motivated to make this happen, because I want to be a user of the technology. But I think the problems and challenges are understood. They clearly need to be solved. But, you know, this is where this is what NVIDIA loves doing, complex problems, hard problems, AI problems. This is what we're all about. So, you know, this is why, you know, why I work here and why I'm going to love it when this comes out and I can actually drive to work without paying attention.
So I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here, but it's right out of the panel discussion. And in many ways, you've already addressed this topic. But in the panel discussion, it says, quote, builders of autonomous vehicles have admitted that the task may be more complex than originally believed, end of quote. Now, you've talked about not knowing whether or not trying to teach a computer or an algorithm whether or not the driver is going to open up that door who just parallel parked, or a box lands with a thud versus getting blown around in the wind. You and I can assess that immediately. It's harder to teach a program to do that. Are those the sorts of more complex than originally believed issues you're talking about, or are there some others that you could bring us up to speed on where they say, maybe this is a little harder than we at first thought?
So it's easier to look at the compute roadmap. That when we first started our autonomous driving platform at NVIDIA, we started with a computer that could do 8 trillion operations per second. And, you know, 8 trillion calculations per second seems like a lot.
Yeah.
But then we realized as we deployed this to customers that people were putting 3, 4, 5 of our systems in a car. And then we're like, okay, maybe that's not enough. So our next gen was 24 trillion operations per second. Again, we thought we were done. Yeah, not even close. And so now our current generation, our Drive Pegasus platform, is 320 trillion operations per second. So now you're on the order of a supercomputer. And this is what we're comfortable with people having what they need in the car. But, you know, the other thing that's happening is that there are sensors that, you know, when we started this, people were only looking at cameras. Now, you know, LIDARs have become things that people like. You have radars, and they're now high-res radars. And then there are IR cameras that are being thrown in the mix. There's high-res ultrasonic sensors. You know, there are all these different sensors now that people want to do, and, you know, for better or worse, all the different car companies we work with all believe in different sensors, very religiously, and different, you know, and we unfortunately have to support them all, but that's fine. And so there's not going to be one solution to this. There's going to be many different solutions to this. But, you know, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to have a sensor ecosystem, but I don't think we ever predicted this. You know, I think when we first started this, we thought, you know, okay, you just put these four cameras here and maybe a radar there and you're done and everyone can adopt that topology. Yeah, didn't happen. And so, you know, you have companies like Tesla that do cameras, radars, and ultrasonic sensors. They don't do any LIDAR. You have other companies that actually swear by LIDARs. I'm seeing people putting LIDARs and radars together, other people putting LIDARs and cameras together. There's every combination of the sun. And so the sad thing is we don't know what we don't know, right? There's not a level five car on the road today. And so until there is, you know, we're going to still discover new problems that we have to solve. You know, the nice thing about it is, and the way we accelerated this discovery is we have a system we call Constellation that's our simulation platform. And, you know, this is one of the things that we've figured out really early on is if you have a fleet that you're testing for autonomous driving, one of the problems is your fleet is located only in certain places, so you only get data from that region. The second thing is 90% of your data, nothing happens. You're driving along, it's just driving as usual. It's when the pedestrian decides to jump out in front of you, when the skateboarder decides to do something unpredictable. It's all those scenarios. And this is where our simulation really can take off, where I can cue up an animal to jump across the road, but it's walking along the road, so you think it's fine, and then suddenly it turns and jumps in front of you. You know, staging that is hard because, of course, it's hard to tell the animal what we want it to do.
Right.
But even more so is the dangerous test cases. When a three-year-old girl dressed in dark clothes crosses the road at night in the rain, you know, I certainly don't want to stage that to see what happens, but I need to know what happens. And then I need to know what happens in the fog, in sleet, you know, and that one test case becomes, you know, thousands of test scenarios. And you can imagine how this blows up really quickly to, you know, maybe it's several million test scenarios I need to actually have passing before I can actually get the car on the road. And this is something that the government agencies have been struggling with is, you know, they don't know how to answer the question yet. How do I certify that a level 5 car is safe enough to be on the road?
I wanted to bring up the legislative issue because I think that's something across a number of technologies that doesn't get talked about enough. But let's come back to that, put a pin in that. Just for the benefit of our listeners, I wanted to clarify one thing. You said there a couple minutes ago that you got up to, you realize now 320 trillion operations per second is what is where you are today. That's what needs to happen to process all the variety of data and input, sensory calculations. That 320 trillion operations per second, that's what's taking place in the computer you're putting in the car or on the chip, or if you could just clarify that a little bit.
Sure. That's what's taking place inside the car. The actual architecture is two system on a chips and then two discrete GPUs. So it's 320 trillion operations per second, 16 CPU cores, 11,000 GPU cores.
Okay. That's pretty extraordinary. Okay, thank you. Now, I just shift gears here for a second, and yes, every pun intended, we're shifting gears. So that we talked about your panel discussion, and you've already touched on this quite a bit, so it's sort of a perfect segue, I guess. Your presentation, Realizing Autonomy Through Sensors, Simulation, and Safety, I really enjoyed hearing what you just said about all the different systems, the different technologies that are going to have to combine to work together. And I'll give just a quick personal note on that. Last September, my wife and I bought a new car, a new for us, certified pre-owned, but we're very happy with it. I won't say the make and the model, but this was the first car we've had that, quote, smart cruise control where it keeps us a specified distance from the car in front of us when I've got the cruise control on, which is always on the highway. You don't use it around town. Now, and of course, the smart sensor there is keeping me at the right distance. A car comes up and moves in between us, then my car automatically adjusts farther back. I love the feature. I mean, I love it. But it probably took me a good 5-6 weeks to really become trusting of it. That was one thing. And then the second thing is this past winter, I'm on the highway, a bit of a snowy-ish kind of day, a little bit of sleet, and this I've got my cruise control on, and I suddenly get this warning on my dashboard. I didn't know what the icon meant. I had to look it up, and sure enough, that front-end sensor was covered up. That's what the icon was telling me. So I said, okay, bad weather. That sensor's covered up with the sleet, snow. To your point just now, about the different technologies, the different redundancies. Are we real close so that on snowy days like that, a sensor you're not so reliant on one sensor or one technology? Because I do love the feature. I do love that it does that.
So the simple answer is yes. And what I see automakers doing is that they know they have to keep these cameras clean or LIDARs or radars. So they're putting heating in, they're putting, I've seen either compressed air or liquid or a wiper. There's a lot of different methods you can do to actually keep the sensor clean. There's, on the other side of it is we know that things happen, whether a bird turd hits part of the sensor or, right. a drop of mud, right? These things happen. And, having lived in Boston, Chicago, I know what inclement weather is and what it can do to you. So we actually, on the other side of it, can recognize through a neural network, through part of an AI, what part of the sensor is still usable. So say, a big water droplet just appears on the camera and I only have half the picture. Well, we actually understand that, and we know that we can only trust half that picture. But this is where what we see car companies doing is putting overlapping sensors. So, with two fisheye cameras, I can cover the whole car. But instead of only putting two cameras, they'll put in six. And these six cameras overlap. So, if any one camera fails, I can, get the same image from the other two adjacent to it.
Okay.
So you have overlapping sensors. The other thing is you put different technologies in. So, this is where I see cameras and radars and LIDARs and ultrasonics and some combination thereof. So if LIDAR tells me there's an object there and radar confirms it, and so does camera, I have a really good, feeling that that's really what's going on. So you double check and triple check what's going on before you do an emergency maneuver or before you take action. So, I think what you saw with your system level two, this is what I don't like about the systems today is they typically rely only on a few sensors. I have this in my car as well, where I have one camera and one radar, and it's only looking forward. And, of course, the problem I have is that if you have to panic stop, the first thing you and I do is look behind you. How close is the car behind me? If I've got a semi-truck behind me, I'm changing lanes, right?
Right.
If I have to panic stop, I need to know, do I need to give the car behind me more time, or can I stop as hard as I can right now? So only looking forward for these systems today is kind of scary. And that's why, I think 2+, where you have this surround perception, you understand what's going on around you. I have multiple sensors. They're overlapping, so I have some redundancy, is really where we need to get to.
The only looking forward sensor is such a great point, because in my car, and I'm a fan of the feature, as I said, I really like it, but I did realize early on, if I'm in the right lane on the highway and I have the smart cruise control on, I'm staying the car is keeping the proper distance from the car in front of me. If a car comes up the on-ramp on my right, my car doesn't know to slow down. And if it's coming up at a certain speed, we're going to collide side to side, and my sensor will have never known it was there. So that's where I have to intervene and say, okay, whoa, there's a car coming up on the right. It'd be great if there was three sensors, two at 45-degree angles going out at the corners, and then that one in the front looking forward. I guess that's next, or maybe it's in higher-end cars. But I did realize that early on. This smart cruise control is great, but there's still things that it simply isn't aware of, like cars coming up the on-ramp at a particular speed. So I'll look forward to that getting a little bit smarter.
But not only that, but, imagine you're going between freeways. I want my car to be able to exit the freeway and merge onto the next freeway, which means I need to know what's going on all around me so I can merge with traffic correctly. This is where you just want to make the system more capable, and you need to have sensors in all directions.
Well, I'll tell you, a lesson I learned a little scary when I was still new with the car and I was kind of feeling my way with it, and you're saying changing freeways. Well, so I live in Connecticut. I'm getting off I-95, turning on to Route 8, all of which is, 55, 60-mile-an-hour driving. And I thought, okay, I'm going to follow the car in front of me. It's slowing down for the ramp because we're going the same way. I'm slowing down. The ramp was such a sharp turn that as soon as it kind of went around the bend, my car started to accelerate very quickly because that car was no longer in front of it. I'm like, oh, geez. I tapped the brake and took back control of the car. I mean, it was never serious, but that's when I started to realize, okay, it's a great feature, but you've got to learn when to use it and what it can and can't do. So here's something that's kind of extreme, and I don't think people would probably trust the car, even though maybe they should, and this might come out of, way out of left field, but the last couple of years, last year in particular, devastating forest fires in California. People who drove out of those forest fires talked about extreme heat. They got out, many of them. I know tragically some didn't. Many people got up, but they would talk about the heat building up in the car, the heat around them, the heat of the road on the tires. Is it something you have to consider, or all the companies in this space have to consider, that after a major event like that, a sensor could be damaged and you wouldn't know it? You see where I'm going? Like, I guess
and the you wouldn't know it is the issue here, that we work with our, we're autonomous car platform, so we work with all our car companies on calibration, self-calibration, self-diagnostics. And the self-diagnostics are running all the time. So essentially the system knows its health. And the key thing is the system needs to know when it can operate safely and when it cannot. And when it cannot, basically it turns into a manual car. But if it can operate safely, meaning all the systems are green, essentially, think of it like, all the pre-flight checks you do in a cockpit of an airplane. You check everything, make sure everything is working correctly, and then, if anything, red flags, then, you call maintenance and you don't take off. It's the same thing in an autonomous car, that you, it's helpful to check around the car to make sure everything is normal, but even if you don't do that, the self-diagnostics and self-calibrations will understand that there's a problem, and it will not operate, will not allow you to go into autonomous mode unless everything is green. The same thing that even when you're driving, say mud takes out the front radar, the front camera, the front LiDAR, and suddenly it no longer can tell what's going on in front of you, well, then either control would turn over to you, and if it doesn't turn over to you, it's called a safe harbor move, that the car understands how to pull itself off to the side of the road and shut down safely.
Okay.
The whole point is that it has to keep you safe and operate in a safe manner no matter what.
That is, first off, that's really reassuring. And secondly, it's just great that kind of forethought, that kind of vision is coming together to bring all these technologies, whichever ones end up being the right ones in the years ahead. I think you and I are on the same page in that whenever this is available, for that long drawn out commute where you'd like to catch up on the morning news, it'll happen while the car is just inching along. Tim, this has been extremely informative. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experience. I think the Drive World Conference and Expo, which is a first of its kind, is going to be really, really exciting. My last point that I would just like you to comment on, if you would, the people at Informa have been planning this event for 3 years. A lot of work, a lot of effort has gone into it. For people who are relatively inexperienced with the whole autonomous vehicle evolution, if they attend for 3 days, what would you like, or what do you think they should walk out thinking when they're done? What should be the big takeaway?
I think that autonomous vehicles are here. They're coming. They're going to be everywhere, whether it's planes, trains, automobiles, bikes, wheelchairs, shopping carts, golf carts, it's going to
18-wheelers? 18-wheeler trucks?
Actually, that's one of the bigger problems, because we're a shortage of truck drivers. So, absolutely, 18-wheelers. It's interesting, in one of our conversations with a customer, we understand the driving space pretty well, but we were introduced to a whole other set of problems with trucks, because there's crosswind issues where the cabs, the trailer's so big and such a huge footprint that when you start getting crosswind, you can actually blow the truck off the road. And so you need to be able to
test
the crosswind before you start skidding. So there are a lot of challenges there, but it's coming. The truck drivers spend so much time on the road The good news is it's an easier problem to solve because, again, they're worried about, you know, cross-country trucking, so it's interstate highways, so they're, you know, yes, fairly tame as far as environment. But, you know, I've got inclement weather to think about. I've got to know, you know, the tire tread on each of the wheels. I need to know what's going on, you know, with the cab, at the, you know, what's going on at the back of the cab, mid-cab, and mid-trailer, front-trailer are all different, you know, things. So I need to understand all those dynamics. So the vehicle dynamics of a truck are a lot more challenging because everything's essentially in the cab up front. All this stuff is coming. You know, anything that essentially moves is going to be autonomous. Hopefully it won't be like WALL-E where we all get fat because no one moves anywhere on their own. But, you know, I think that's the direction we're headed where, you know, the whole point is there's no reason to have any kind of lives or anyone hurt or anyone killed by these, you know, vehicles or collisions or anything. We need to just basically be able to get from point A to point B safely no matter what.
And that for everyone who is attending the Drive World Conference, that is your takeaway. Tim Wong, you will be presenting Wednesday, August 28th from 9 to 9:45. It's your talk, Realizing Autonomy Through Sensors, Simulation, and Safety. And then a day later, you'll be part of the panel discussion, August 29th, 11:15 to 12 o'clock, the timeline to getting to level 5 autonomy, is it realistic? Tim, you have been a wealth of information today. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experience. Have a great conference, and I look forward to our talking again.
That sounds great.